And now, Move the Sticks with Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks.
What's going on, everybody? DJ Bucky here. Hope you're having a great day. We are we're jam-packed with things to talk about, Buck. I feel like every minute there's a new story that pops up that grabs our attention. Definitely busy times here in the in-season / off-season portion of the year.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. We knew the hiring cycle, the coaches' hiring cycle, would kind of pop after that first round of playoff games, and man, has it popped like crazy. And it seems like today is the day where everyone decided they wanted to hire their head coach. And so it has been fast and furious this morning. And so we'll talk about all the news. We'll talk about the quarterbacks in the top 2020 quarterback prospects with Tua entering the fray. And then maybe, just maybe, if we have a little time, we'll touch on the divisional round playoffs. But maybe we'll talk about that on Thursday. We'll see.
Yeah, we've got plenty of time to get into those. I do want to start, before we get into the new head coaches for the Carolina Panthers and the New York Giants, how about the Cleveland Browns, Buck? We talked about it yesterday, about Jim Schwartz potentially being a fit there, and news comes out last night. They request to get an interview with Jim Schwartz.
You think they listen?
Talk to him. Now we just need him to talk to Coach Caldwell. So I don't know. I'm not saying they're listening.
Think,
I'm just
think,
saying that this is a coincidence.
You think they might be listening?
We brought this up, and it happened.
Yeah, someone in the building might be listening to the podcast.
You know,
maybe
one thing happened, another thing happened.
DJ, they're really running out of names based on what Jim Haslin had said that he wanted for this coach. He wanted an experienced coach, a guy who had kind of done it in the National Football League. So he's kind of done the song and dance. And so when you look at the available candidates, I mean, you have Josh McDaniels. Jim Schwartz has emerged as one. We talked about Jim Caldwell, but, I mean, who else is out there? I mean, I can't imagine Marvin Lewis kind of being in the fray. Like, if you're the Cleveland Browns and you want an experienced coach, I mean, your pool is really, really thin. The good thing is everyone else has kind of filled up the dance card. Like, everybody else is kind of in position to take those jobs. And so they have everything.
Taking time now.
Yeah, but the only thing about it is the longer that you wait when you're the Browns, man, it's hard to get the assistant coaches. And that ultimately can undermine whatever your head coach wants to do. So they kind of need to make the decision quickly so they can get the best assistance that they can to kind of build a complete staff. But it is about getting it right. And as you pointed out on the pod yesterday with Jim Schwartz, look, Jim Schwartz does have a good mix of, look, he has the football background. He has the analytics that he's all about. Look, he's a Georgetown graduate. He has used numbers and data to kind of help him when it comes to being a head coach and also as a defensive coordinator. I think he's probably wiser and smarter going into it the second time around based on his experience with the Detroit Lions. He took over and inherited a tough job in Detroit, got them to a level where they played at a playoff level, had the young quarterback that he kind of shepherded and helped him grow into being a franchise quarterback. So there are definitely some positives when it comes there. I think the big thing, whoever takes this job with the personalities that are in that locker room, you got to have a strong personality. And you have to be able to kind of set the line very, very clear in the sand. And you have to be able to then, if they step over the line, you then have to make sure that there are consequences to those actions. Before we can think about play caller and all that other stuff, the guy who is in charge in Cleveland, he has to be a leader. He has to have a clear vision, and he has to be able to set the standard and expectations for how his players are going to play and perform on and off the field.
No doubt. And one thing somebody brought up to me after listening to the episode, which I didn't even make this connection, Buck. I don't know how I didn't put this together. But Jimmy Haslam, most people know, is a Nashville guy. His brother was the governor in Tennessee. And you've got Jim Schwartz, who, you know, obviously his reputation was earned as a defensive coordinator there with the Tennessee Titans. So I don't know if there's a relationship between him and the Haslams, but there is a Tennessee connection there between them.
Yeah, you know, like I do wonder what that connection is like and where they're connected and how they kind of come to be. But, you know, the only thing that troubles me about the Cleveland Browns is the constant turnover and the instability. And so I believe this is one where Schwartz and his representatives, you have to almost make the deal like an ironclad deal where it is so much money, the buyout is so prohibitive that you have an opportunity to really put your plan in place, at least see it through 3 years before they can pull the plug and think about doing something else. I think that's the big thing. If I'm in play for the Cleveland Brown job, I want them to be very vested in what the vision is and to give me the opportunity to see it through. I don't know if anyone previously has really gotten the opportunity to see their plan through to a reasonable term to be able to say, hey, you know what? This plan didn't necessarily work. It's just hard to do a turnaround in a year or two.
No doubt. I think it's going to be very interesting to see what they do. You brought up a great point, though, with the assistant coaches. They, that does put a little urgency there to get this done so you don't lose out on all the top assistants as they're all trying to play musical chairs there. I want to get to these two new hires here in a second, Buck, but one other point. I was just thinking about this, draft-related. When you look at what we talked about yesterday and we talked about the Detroit Lions, potentially that number three pick being a trade pick, when you look at the quarterback needy teams being 5, 6, and 7, right? That's 5, the Miami Dolphins, 6, the Los Angeles Chargers, 7, the Carolina Panthers, who now have their new head coach, Matt Rhule, which we'll get to in a second. But I start thinking there, the Lions would have an interesting decision to make because they've stuck with Matt Patricia and Bob Quinn. Which makes me believe like there's pressure on them to win right now. Mm-hmm. But if you took a big picture look at it and said, you know what, if we took Tua, maybe we're going to endure a down year here. Maybe Tua doesn't play this year. We take Tua. You put Matthew Stafford on the block, you would fetch a king's ransom for him if you decided we want to let's take a little bit of a longer term look at this thing. I'm not saying I would do that. I think Matthew Stafford's more talented than Tua, but I'm just saying those are discussions. I think people, don't always understand this. The smart thing to do if you're running an organization is to vet out all these possibilities. What does it look like if we do this? What would be available to us? What could we do with these resources we would accumulate? When you take that money off the books, you get a cheaper rookie deal for 5 years, allows you to build up the rest of your roster, and you get a haul of picks. I'm not saying I would do it, Buck, but I'm saying that's an exercise I think the Detroit Lions need to go through before we get to April.
Hey, look, man, that's an excellent exercise. Remember last year, DJ draft time, there were some rumblings and some conversations that maybe they would kick the tires on a quarterback in the top 10 when they took TJ Hockenson, that maybe if there was a quarterback there, they would explore the possibility of bringing one in. Not necessarily because they have fallen out of favor with Matthew Stafford, but look, he's an older quarterback. It is better to get a young replacement or successor early than late. Now you're at really what we call, you're in prime territory now. You're in the top 5. You're sitting in number 3. You know there are 4 teams behind you that need a quarterback. You also have something that you can offer in terms of a legitimate franchise quarterback. And so there are a couple of ways that they could go. They could pawn off the pick so someone could jump up and maybe take Tua or one of the quarterbacks that they deem to be their guy. They could hold on to 3 and trade out Matthew Stafford like you suggested. And, man, I would have to think that Matthew Stafford would bring back at a minimum 2 1s, right? Like at a minimum, you have to be talking about 2 1s and
here's my question, and I'm just pulling this out of the sky here because I'm going to ask you to be the general manager and see if you would do this. I don't have the draft order in front of me, but I believe the Raiders are something like, 12-19, I think? 2 top 20 picks.
Ooh.
If you're Mike Mayock and John Gruden,
yes.
I don't think that would even be enough. I think it would cost you those 2 1s, and maybe it's next year's, two. 2 1s and a 2, maybe. I don't know, but I mean that's all of a sudden now. If you're Detroit, if you really did like, Tua, and you felt he was healthy, and you thought you could move forward with him, man, you've got a chance to add a lot of pieces. And I'm thinking if I'm the Las Vegas Raiders going into a new building, and I could trot out Matthew Stafford for that first game.
See, because then
I'd be thinking long and hard about that one.
Because then it also plays into we give up the 2 1s and we may give up a 2 next year. But then when we trade Derek Carr, we'll recoup some of that stuff back.
We may not get
we won't.
Assuming you can find a partner.
Yeah, we may not be able to get the 1s back, But we certainly can get some twos and some threes for Derek Carr because he's a proven quarterback. And, look, whatever you think about him, you think about him. But he has been a starting quarterback in the league, and he would fall in maybe that top 20 when it comes to evaluating the quarterbacks, the starting quarterbacks in the league. There is a value to that. Man, Man, you talk about getting into trade.
I took a left turn on this podcast.
I think it's interesting, and I also think it's interesting as we continue to talk about these new head coaches, right? Because some of these head coaches are going to inherit quarterback situations that they may or may not like, and so then you have to make a decision. If I'm starting off my tenure, do I want to even start off? Like if I'm Matt Rule, do I want to start off with Cam Newton for another year before I really get a chance to jumpstart
the rebuild?
You know, like some of those things. So all of these guys have to do it. But I think this Matthew Stafford, Detroit Lions number three pick situation is something that I'm sure we have to discuss on multiple times, because as the draft gets closer, I think it will heat up conversations about that pick and potentially about their franchise quarterback.
Well, I want to jump into Matt Rule here and talk about that and the decision he has to make. Now, a lot of people are, you know, talking about his success at the collegiate level. I've seen people comparing him. You know, well, we've seen Chip Kelly, you know, Steve Spurrier, these different people try and make this jump, mixed results. And we need to remind people, look, he has some NFL experience, and he has some NFL experience under a guy who's won some Super Bowls in Tom Coughlin. And we had a chance to talk to Matt Rule about some of the things he learned under Coach Coughlin. We'll play a little snippet of that right here.
He spent so much time with the players one-on-one. And there's always kind of this thing out there about Coach Coughlin, like, you know, he was a drill sergeant. Blah, blah, blah. But, like, he would meet with Justin Tuck, and he would meet with Eli, and he would meet with, you know, Akeem Nix. And he would meet with those guys one-on-one and talk to them. And that way, like, they weren't really getting called out, but they were hearing his message from him. And to me, you know, I always tell we asked earlier about leadership. I always tell our coaches and our players, you know, our message, your words, man. Like, you know, like I'm going to say it one way, you know, you say it another way and make it way cooler. That's fine. But our message, your words. And that's their chance to say, coach, I don't like that message. And so, you know, whereas I used to be a little bit more of, you know, probably, you know, team meeting, yeller and screamer on the practice field. I mean, I still am an intense guy. But I spend a lot of time with my players. I spend a lot of time one-on-one. I spend a lot of time with two or three guys. I watch the tape with, the backup left tackle, just one-on-one. And I learned that from Coach Coughlin because he built amazing connections that way. And you need that when you go to a place like New York where the media and everything's under the microscope. He did it one-on-one in close quarters. And I thought it's what allowed him to have a tremendous amount of success.
Well, Buck, you get a chance to hear that back again. You could definitely hear the influence there with Coach Coughlin. And I think Matt Rule comes into this a little bit more equipped than maybe the average college coach would, making this jump. But to me, the biggest information that came out of him going to Carolina was the length of the contract. 7-year contract worth up to, I believe, $70 million is what's out there, what's being reported. And if you look at Coach Rule's track record, the first year is rough. You know, the first year he's taken over programs, it's been rough. And then the second year they get up and rolling, and then they take off. And so to me, when you're looking at the decision to make with Cam Newton is your quarterback if you're hell-bent on winning a bunch of games and trying to be the best you can be in the short term. I don't think that's necessarily going to be the long-term answer there for Carolina. So if the contract length says long-term, you're our guy. If his track record says we're thinking long-term, that, to me, does not point to Cam Newton being with the Carolina Panthers next year. That's just me on the outside looking in.
Yeah, like so here's the thing about the Cam Newton conversation, and I hear people talk about the Cam Newton thing. But when I look at the deal, DJ, the deal is $19 million. The deal
He's
is
not
like,
making that much money.
Like
yeah.
the deal is half of what Russell Wilson is making. The deal is like, It pales in comparison to what Jared Goff and Carson Wentz and Dak Prescott will make. I believe if I'm Matt Rule, I think you have an opportunity to do a couple different things. I think you can hold on to Cam Newton while ushering in a younger guy, potentially. But I think here's where it all hinges on. It hinges on going to the conversation, having a chat with the director of college scouting, and asking him, what do we think about the 2021 quarterback class? And are we confident that there are 1, 2, 3 players in that class that would be franchise players? Because if there are 3 players that are franchise caliber in that class at the quarterback position, I think you can move on from Cam Newton. You look, you take all the L's and the losses, and you put yourself in a position to get a Trevor Lawrence, a Justin Fields, whoever else may be in the class.
Oh, can you imagine Trevor Lawrence in that market there? You know that area.
I mean, yeah, but you're going to have to tank. You're going to have to make sure you lose all of them.
all the way.
I mean, you're going to have to make sure.
They might have too many good players
he's going to, I mean, unless something changes dramatically, like a Joe Burrow emerges and kind of takes over, like he'll be the presumptive number one. But, yeah, Matt Rhule has to make a decision. But based on our conversations, DJ, I think he's a long-term planner. I don't think he deliberately tears down things. Like, this would probably, in my mind, be the best situation that he's inherited because he does have some good players. In those other situations, I don't know if he inherited a team that was kind of ready, built, and ready to win. And I'm not saying Carolina's all the way ready to win, but I think they are certainly competitive. And so he has to kind of weigh what is the best way to set this up for long-term success. Can he rebuild while still winning? We saw the Seattle Seahawks were able to do that with Russell Wilson when they completely flipped the team while having a quarterback there, and it worked for them.
Yep.
It just kind of depends on how quickly he can assess where his team is, how quickly he can kind of figure out what the landscape is in the NFC South, and what do we need to do to eventually be the bully in that division.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what he does. And I'm anxious to see staffing-wise, fly the play down to Waco and throw all your coaches on there and take them all with you?
Or yeah, I don't think you can do that.
Some more NFL guys. Yeah, I know, but it's going to be fascinating to see what he does.
He
puts this whole thing together.
God, man, it will be fascinating.
Because that was the reported issue with the Jets when he was talking with them last year, is they did not agree on staffing. So I got to believe when you give him as many years and as much money as Carolina has given him, it's going to be his call there on what he wants to put together staff-wise.
One other thing that I wonder about.
Overall, though, you know, in our visits with Coach Rhule, go ahead.
One thing that I do wonder, what do they do personnel-wise now? Like, because when he has 7 years and he has that kind of money, he is in charge. So does that mean that Marty Herney moves up in terms of a more like a presidential role, and then they bring another football guy in? How does Matt Rhule want to handle the personnel part of the organization? We've heard David Tepper talk about wanting to kind of, you know, become forward thinking on that side of the building, the football side of the building. So does that mean that they have an analytics based operation? Do they have a kind of like an old school general manager type that comes in knowing that Matt Rhule has the big stick? It'd be interesting to see how they kind of retool and rebuild their personnel side while also rebuilding their team.
The way I understand it is they're going to bring in somebody on the personnel side. Marty Herney is going to be kind of elevated, or, you know, almost going to serve as a liaison there with a new personnel guy coming in. Marty, obviously, with the experience, you know him well, is able to really, you know, work well with a lot of different people, and I think he'll be an asset to whoever comes in. The only trouble will be, initially, it sounds like it's not going to be a general manager's title, so you're not going to be able to get people out of contracts because you're not going to have any authority over the 53, which is going to prohibit teams, guys from being able to get out from their existing deals. So that limits a little bit of your field in terms of who you can go after. But, you know, that'll be an interesting hire. And I'm sure Coach Rhule will have a lot to say with who that person is, someone that he wants to work with. But make no mistake, we always talk about it, Buck. People always ask the question, who has the juice? Who has the power? Like, every 2 weeks, you'll find out. I mean, that is a healthy chunk there for Coach Rhule. So, you know, he's got the influence there in the building.
Oh, he definitely has all the sway in the building. I mean, that's a big check that he has. And I think it's good, man. He's one of the guys that I've grown to admire. I've grown to really respect a lot from multiple interactions. The time that we had him on the podcast, interview him at the combine. I really like the direction. I also like the fact that I don't think he is a huge change from Ron Rivera from a philosophical standpoint. So I don't know if they have to completely blow up their roster to kind of play to the vision that he wants to play. Ron Rivera wanted a tough physical football team. I believe Matt Rhule has said that's how he kind of wants to play rough and tumble football. He has a running back in place. Depending on what you think about the quarterback, they got some young pieces. But at least from a style standpoint, the personnel that he inherits, kind of fits the way that he wants to play. He just has to make some tweaks and adjustments to kind of really fill out his vision. But look, I like the hire. I thought it was a smart hire. And I actually like the Carolina Panthers situation better for Matt Rhule than the New York Giants situation, which was really, really talked about a lot.
Yeah, the only thing that I would say the advantage would go to the Giants would be just that they have their young quarterback going forward, whereas the waters are a little murky there in Carolina. But again, that's why you get 7 years on the contract. You've got time to kind of sort that out. But everything I've heard, when you talk about ownership there in Carolina, top-notch. They're going to have new facilities. It's a full-on commitment there to do whatever needs to be done to be a sustained winner there. So I have a lot of belief there in Coach Rhule that he's going to get that thing rolling in Carolina. The job everybody thought he was going to get, Buck, the New York Giants, they announced their coach. They go in a different direction. They go to New England, but it wasn't for Josh McDaniels. It was actually for Joe Judge, who – man, when reading about him, Buck, I'll be honest with you, I did not know a lot about him, but reading up on him, you know, long history there as a special teams coach, was under Scotty O'Brien, who's kind of a legendary special teams coach in the NFL for a long time, Scotty O. And then this past year has actually added the duties of receiver coach to his mix there. So you have somebody that's coaching special teams and a receivers coach, which does remind a lot of folks of John Harbaugh and his last I think it was last year or 2 years in Philadelphia under Andy Reid, where he actually started coaching in the secondary to go along with what he did on the special team side to make himself a little more well-rounded.
You know what, man? As a former special teams player, like basically my entire career was just about playing special teams, not necessarily on offense and defense. I really applaud the move, and I really hope that this begins to kind of set off a different trend. I believe special teams coaches have been overlooked as viable head coaching candidates, and I believe – what special team coaches can offer that an offensive coordinator and a defensive coordinator can offer is that they are comfortable standing in front of the entire room because they coach guys from both phases. They are the ones who not only have to coach guys from both sides of the ball, but they also have to instruct the coaches. Because we've seen it at practice, DJ, when you're the special teams coach, the special team coach will have the wide receiver coach working with the gunners on releases. He'll have the DB coach working with the vice guys. He'll have the linebacker coaches and those guys working with the holdup guys. And he'll have maybe the running backs coach working with the returners. And so just in watching them manage a practice, we see their management skills in terms of being able to delegate responsibilities to the staff, being able to tie it all together. And then on game day, I think they are well prepared to be game managers, understanding clock and situation, understanding what we want to do. I think they have to think about the game as a head coach before they're tasked with the responsibility of being the head coach. I don't know much about Joe Judge, but I will say this, just from what he's been given from a responsibility standpoint during his time in New England, I think he should be well prepared to be the leader. Now, we'll see if it plays out, but I'm glad that they finally tapped into the special teams coach market because I believe it is one of the I think you can find hidden gems in that coaching carousel when you go to the special teams coaches because there are a lot of good guys who understand a lot more about the game than just play calling. I think they're better prepared to be head coaches.
All right, Buck, two questions. Over the last, 20 years, best coach in college football is who?
Well, I mean, you can say Urban Meyer and you say Nick Saban, but I would say Urban Meyer.
Who's won six?
Nick Saban
has won six national championships.
Nick Saban has won a ton.
Who's won six?
Nick Saban has won.
Who's won the most Super Bowls? Who's the best NFL coach over the last 20 years?
Bill Belichick.
So, yeah. Joe Judge, time at Alabama and time with New England. He's had a chance to be around what most people would agree, the best two coaches, regardless of football, or regardless of level, for the last 20 years. This guy's been impacted by both of them, had a chance to learn under both of them. Not a bad resume to put together for a guy who's 38 years old. And I also love the fact, so many times people are always looking for that next job, Buck. They don't handle their business. And when he was at a lower level, in a lower role, I should say, at Alabama, to me, and I don't know this for a fact, but I know with a lot of guys like this, when they make the move from there to then go into a, basically a QC job, quality control job in the NFL with the team, it's because those personnel have been on campus and you've impressed them with your interactions with them and what you've done. So he obviously did something to catch the eye of Bill Belichick and the New England Patriots group with what he was doing at Alabama, and he was not in an elevated role. So that to me is another example of if you focus on the job that you have, do a great job, treat people the right way, not only do people in your building notice, people that come into your building from the outside, they notice as well.
Yeah, I think they do notice as well. Now, look, I didn't know about the Alabama connection. I think it's great for you to bring up the Alabama New England connection. I think there's a lot to be learned in that. You talked about him kind of being a worker bee, doing all the grunt work for Nick Saban, doing a lot of the grunt work for Bill Belichick, then ascending to being the special teams coach and the wide receivers coach. Look, man, the one thing that we know, both of those guys are taskmasters. They put a lot of responsibilities on everybody in the building, particularly the lower level people. They also teach you how to coach. The one thing that Joe Judge has to prove to everyone is that he can be his own guy, that he doesn't try to come and stand in front of the room and become Bill Belichick or Nick Saban. The guys who have struggled that have come out of New England were guys that tried to be like Bill Belichick. They tried to do the same things without really doing it within their own personality. If he can take all of the wonderful things that he learned from New England and Alabama, but present it in a package that is his, that is real and authentic, he can have success. But if he goes up and he tries to copy those that have influenced him, then he will have a struggle, because we have seen it. Players have a tough time when they can sense that this isn't who you really are. He just has to be himself. If he does that, he could do a really good job in New York.
No doubt. Well, it's going to be interesting then on the college level. Mississippi State was a job that a lot of people thought Joe Judge was going to take because he had played there. That job still remains open. Now Baylor's open after Matt Rhule left. So we'll see. Maybe we see some NFL guys go down to the college level here for those two jobs.
I want to touch on
that storyline.
DJ, the Baylor job, right? The Baylor job is interesting to me because Matt Rhule had done a really good job of not only building it up, but he had done a really good job with recruiting. I wonder if you're Baylor administration, where do you go from here? Because he's done a really good job of getting them to kind of play in his own image. Where does that next coach come from? Because if the next coach, does he change what has been really working well for Baylor? Like, look, I can't fault a guy for leaving to take what he perceives to be a better job. But, man, I think it does have to put Baylor in a bit of a bind at this late stage of the process.
Well, I think two things. Number one, I don't know, you know, that was probably the ceiling, you know, for Baylor,
what for
they
sure
were to do this year. They were, a whisker away from being in the postseason. So strike while the iron's hot. I get that if you're Matt Rhule. But I thought, you know, with the Big 12 being as pass happy and as wide open, and Baylor had a lot of speed. He talked about that with us, how he built his team around speed. But he installed a little bit of toughness there and some defensive mentality into that program, which I think we always talk about. You zig when everybody else is zagging, and that's a conference. It's all been offense, 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 and he did a nice job of instilling some toughness and building up the defense. So, I don't go out and hire somebody that runs the air raid or somebody that's going to, you know, that is like everybody else in the Big 12. You've got to find somebody that has a little bit of that toughness gene that Matt Rhule placed into that program. That, to me, is the profile for what you need to look for.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting. It'd be interesting to see. It'd be also be interesting to see what the pool of candidates look like for both of those jobs, Baylor and Mississippi State. Mississippi State job is a hard job. It's kind of hard sometimes to attract candidates down there just because of Starkville or whatever. And then Baylor, I think you look at that job and you think that might be a prime job because the Big 12 does seem like it's coming back to the pack, and Baylor has an opportunity maybe to have some staying power.
Can we make an executive decision here, Buck? I know we were talking about previewing some of these playoff games for the weekend, but we have another show coming up on Thursday. Can we punt that to Thursday and we talk about some of these kids?
I think we should. Yeah, let's punt on that. Let's talk about some of these kids that are entering the draft, some of the quarterbacks and stuff.
I know you wanted to touch on the quarterbacks, so why don't you take us off the right there?
Well, look, man, like just starting with Tua, I think what's fascinating about this quarterback class, DJ, I still think that it's kind of like the Big 2 plus 1, right? So we'll lump these guys as the top three, Tua, Joe Burrow, and Justin Herbert. And I think everyone will say that, look, Joe Burrow and Tua may have some separation from Justin Herbert. When you think about Tua, I think the thing that is fascinating to me about Tua is, look, the injury history is what it is. He has had a series of ankles. He had a knee. He's had the hip. But when you look at the talent, I think the talent is undeniable. I think if I had to rank these three in terms of just pure talent, I think he's the most talented of them all. Yesterday, you talked about his arm strength and maybe not being like what it is, a strong arm. But I think he has more pace on his ball than Joe Burrow. And I think he has more pace on his ball than Justin Herbert. And his compact release, which is unconventional to me for a left-hander, the ball comes out, man, it comes out white hot and it comes out on time. When he plays and he is protected and he's in the pocket, he absolutely deals. I will say the one thing that I worry about is Tua is a third-year junior. Game experience-wise, though, because of the injuries and because of how he kind of earned the job kind of late, I mean, not even really that freshman year, but like sophomore year, he doesn't have a lot of game experience, like the kind of game experience that leads you to believe like, oh, okay, I know exactly what I'm getting from him. But I do believe the ceiling is high if healthy. I do believe he has some of that Drew Brees in his game in terms of how he can play it. I know there'd be some comparisons to Russell Wilson. I don't know if he moves like Russell in terms of like how smooth he is, how explosive he is. With that, I think he at his best is a guy that maybe can grow and become a Drew Brees-like player that can deal from the pocket.
Yeah, I really like him, man. I do. And I know there's some people that are split on him, but I just watch. I've gotten big into this just urgency and twitch and suddenness in the pocket. It's just kind of been my thing I've been looking at over the last, you know, 5 years when you look at guys that have really been successful. He's got that. He's got that twitch. Now, the hip, hopefully he can get back to what he was. That's an unknown. I don't know how to speak on that. Not a doctor. So you have to rely on the medical people for that. But I went through the checklist the other day. I mean, to me, the quarterback checklist, he's pretty darn impressive in all those areas. Accuracy, poise, decision-making, leadership, work ethic, you know, playmaking ability. Those are all kind of the key things I look for at the position, and he checks all those boxes. Now, he's not the biggest guy in the world, you know, but we've seen that kind of that stigma kind of go by the wayside here the last couple years. So, I don't know. I really, really like him, Buck. I think he's going to be a very efficient, effective passer. I know the knocks on him. People, oh, he just throws slants all day long. Well, turn on some NFL football and watch what they're doing right now because it's a lot of the same stuff. Make a quick decision. Get the ball out of your hands. Be very accurate with the football, and that's what he is. He is not going to wow you with Pat Mahomes, Josh Allen type, you know, arm talent, arm strength, whatever you want to call it. He doesn't have that type of power, but he's going to slice and dice you 10, 15 yards at a time.
Yeah, and I think that's why, like, when I look at him, I see him playing in a Sean Payton-type offense where Drew Brees has really been great and masterful at the 10 and under game, really working the intermediate part of the game. And really, that's really where most of the people kind of butter their bread, being able to efficiently carve up defenses. I believe he is well-suited to be able to do that. And so that brings me to Joe Burrow because I think just year – Joe Burrow has also shown similar traits in terms of being able to carve up defenses, working horizontally and also vertically. I think his ability, I kind of wrote in my notes when I was studying him, man, he is the master of the RPO game. I don't know if I've seen a quarterback that gets it as well as he gets it, maybe since Deshaun, because I feel like Deshaun Watson really understood the RPO game in terms of really playing the manipulation game with that hang defender. I think Joe Burrow really understands that really, really well. I think he is athletic enough to also utilize his legs to be a factor on the zone read RPO game where he can kind of pull it three, four, five times a game and make some plays. You and I have talked privately about, man, his poise and how cool and calm he is within the pocket. I think it's a stark contrast from what he showed his junior year to being able to show his senior year how he's very, very comfortable in the chaos and the traffic. And once or twice a game, he makes a play because he understands where it's coming from. He can slide, maneuver, elude, and evade and make plays. And then, look, he's deadly accurate. And so all of those things really come out. I think the thing that kind of makes me pause just a little bit is just because it is such a drastic jump from 1 year to the next that – it's just scary as an evaluator to kind of wonder what is he going to get. And until you're able to really talk to the coaches down there and to get a sense of, well, what happened from junior to senior year, how big of an influence was Joe Brady bringing in some offensive concepts that really helped him, how much of it was Joe Burrow really developing and kind of doing all the dirty work to become a great player. And I think once you kind of get all of that and you can kind of swish it around and kind of figure out what to make of it and what will continue to happen going forward, then I think you can put an accurate assessment or a solid evaluation. To me, it's still TBD. I know he's really good. I just don't know where I would put him in terms of like that final grade.
Yeah, he's going to beat you with his anticipation. He's going to beat you with his awareness. He's not going to beat you with his arm. Like, that's just – that's how he's going to play. And we've seen guys be very successful playing that way. It's just – you know, I think we've seen – you know, you look at Carson Wentz. You know, I mentioned, you know, you see Josh Allen. You see Patrick Mahomes. And even I would say Deshaun has a much stronger arm than Joe Burrow. These guys can wait a little bit. Joe Burrow is not going to wait, which means he's going to have to be comfortable in the system. Put him in the right system where he can be comfortable, and he knows where guys are going to be, and then he will beat you with anticipation, timing, and touch. That's just the way he plays. But I'm also, when I look at these top two guys, Buck, everything I've heard, the competitiveness that they bring, the leadership, that kind of alpha mentality that we talk about, that's who these guys are, both these guys. And they come in and they change the temperature of the room a little bit with their leadership style and presence. And that, to me, is it's not underrated, man. I mean, it's not overrated. That is a real, real deal. And you talk to people around the league and you talk about what they want at that position. They want that guy to have that it factor, whatever you want to call it. Both these guys have it, and they have it in spades.
It's funny because on the Elite 11 Tour, we call those guys that change the temperature in the room, we call them thermostat leaders. Guys that when they step in, it changes. Yeah. Like, it gets a little warmer, it gets a little hotter because they create the pressure in the environment that enables guys to play at a higher level. And I can speak really about Tua, having known Tua, having coached him in high school. I can tell you unequivocally, he's one of the best leaders I've ever been around in terms of watching him lead in his own way and getting guys to kind of fall in line. Great leader, great person, does all those things. In terms of what I've heard from people that have been around the LSU program and even at Ohio State about Joe Burrow, he also is that guy. Ultra competitive, great worker. When you look at the interactions, you and I have talked about how big it is to go to games and watch how teammates respond to the quarterback and where does the quarterback go in between breaks. Does he go and hang with the fellas? Is he by himself? Do you see him interact and engage? The love that LSU has for Joe Burrow, the love that his teammates, the genuine affection that you see them display towards him after he wins awards, or after he does great things on the field, to me, that's real. And that matters a lot. And so I am more likely to believe that he can continue to carry those connections to the next level. But with both of these guys, I do believe system matters for both of them. They need to play in the right system to enhance what they do. And I think, look, it shouldn't be a big concern because we've seen the league has been more willing to bend to the young quarterback. And I think it's just very, very important that whoever inherits or takes these guys, they have a clear plan in place to really play these guys the way that they've played in college so they can replicate that success as pros.
All right, last one here, Justin Herbert. And talking to somebody in the league the other day, they brought up a great point with him. A lot of people were kind of setting their ways on Herbert, you know, coming down the stretch. The last two games changed some things. And the reason was they finally cut him loose and let him run, called some design runs. And now people are saying, okay, we can expand our playbook a little bit with his ability and his athleticism. They just didn't have him do it, which was baffling to me. I mean, they won the Rose Bowl, had a great year at Oregon, but man, he's a big, sturdy guy. He could have taken some more punishment there. He could absorb that as a rusher and could have been more explosive and dynamic as a player because he's a phenomenal athlete. They just didn't ask him to do it. But him showing that he could do that over the last couple weeks, I think it's caused people to go back and reevaluate a little bit because I think a lot of people were kind of, you know, I like him, I don't love him. I think he did really help himself at the end of the year with what he did with his legs.
DJ, in the middle of the Rose Bowl, I said that the Rose Bowl performance and the last two performances would impact Justin Herbert more than any other player. And part of it was because we've seen him do things that we hadn't saw him do. We didn't watch him do the entire year. Now, in talking to the Oregon people, they didn't have a backup quarterback that they trusted. And when he got hurt a year ago or a couple years ago, when they had to go to the backups, it wasn't good. And so part of the reason why they didn't really run him, they couldn't afford to put him in jeopardy where they would have to put the quarterback to on the field. And so what we saw is, well, now when you reach the Pac-12 title game, all bets are off. We're trying to win the championship. When you get to the Rose Bowl, it's go time. And I think because of the way that he played in go time, to me, I was like, oh, okay. I could see him doing some things. In the Rose Bowl, look, man, he was at about 50% completion rate. But the toughness that he displayed, the athleticism that he displayed, the leadership that he displayed, to me, earned him far more points than he would have earned if he was 26 for 28 for 400 yards. I just believe that some people will look at the success that Drew Lock had and say, you know, if we put him in the same kind of system that Shanahan, Kubiak, stretch boot, play action, get on the edge, simple reads, but utilizing the athleticism that he displays, I absolutely believe that Justin Herbert could be a frontline starter and can have success. I just believe with all of them, but even maybe him more than the other two, system fit is very important for Justin Herbert. And I'll throw another bonus thing. It's not only system fit, I would say coach's temperament. I don't know, and don't ask me where I get this from, I don't know if he can have a hard, gruff, in him coach to lead him. And I don't know where that comes from, but my observation is I want someone that can nurture him and kind of bring out that thing, because he's already introverted. I want him to be very, very comfortable in his skin and lead in his own way.
Well, that's a good point. Did you see this, by the way? Did you see the video of him looking at the video of Joey Harrington? Did you see that?
Yes, I did see that. I did see that because he had the jerseys on.
Everybody in the league, and he was like, "Look, yeah." And Joey Harrington, look, and you got to understand, Herbert grew up in Eugene.
In Eugene, Joey Harrington was the big deal,
and Joey Harrington, that was the guy. That was the guy. So I think from a national standpoint, because somebody I was talking to is a big Joe Burrow guy. And they weren't a big Justin Herbert guy. Mm-hmm. And he brought up, he was trying to be funny. He was like, look, Joe Burrow cried after he was hoisting up the Heisman Trophy. And Justin Herbert cried when he got a video from Joey Harrington. Like, you know, I'm more of a Joe Burrow guy. But I was like, yeah, you got to understand. Joey Harrington's a big deal up there in the Pacific Northwest. But it was, I think for people that don't know the background there, like, man, Joey Harrington just moved this guy to tears. Like, that's Joey Harrington hasn't made anybody cry in a long time. That was for a different reason.
No, I know. I know, but I thought it was really cool. Look, I would equate what Justin Herbert, his affinity for Oregon was probably my affinity for North Carolina. And so if I got a thing from Lawrence Taylor when I was –
Did Rasheed Wallace make you cry?
No, he didn't make me cry because we're peers. We're teammates. However, if Kenny Smith or if Michael Jordan had sent me a personalized video, I might have
Sam Perkins.
Rolled up. Sam Perkins. Yeah, that's all my crew. Like, that's the same thing. So I can understand and relate to Justin Herbert being excited about Joey Harrington, because on the ABC piece, what they also showed, they showed Herbert and his brother in Joey Harrington jerseys. And so for it to come full circle, I thought it was pretty cool.
Ah, well, there you go. Well, that was fun kind of working through those quarterbacks. I've started to work on Eason a little bit, who's got a lot of talent there at Washington. We'll see what happens with some of these other decisions. I would imagine Jake Fromm's going to come out. He hasn't not made a decision as we're recording this, but Buck, when you've started 40-plus games, his whole offensive line's gone. His offensive line coach left. His running back's gone. There's plenty to evaluate there. You kind of know what Jake Fromm is, for better, for worse. You like him, you don't like him. I don't really see how that changes if he goes back to Georgia. But we'll see what his decision is and what he makes. But he'll factor in there at some place.
Yeah, he definitely will factor in there. It's interesting, right, because that tier below what we call the top three, you're trying to figure it out, right?
You got Jordan Love, too.
You got Jacob Eason, you have Jake Fromm, you have Jordan Love. You have those guys in the conversation. You just kind of wonder where he fits. I don't know what the ceiling is, like how high that ceiling is for Jake Fromm, and I don't know if he would benefit from going back. You know, it's a tough one because, man, when you lose all your people around you, gosh, man, he could look bad while being a better player. He could look like a worse prospect. A lesser prospect, despite being a better player, and it just doesn't show up because he doesn't have the weapons around him.
All right, Buck. Let's wrap this thing up, man. We're gonna get to these playoff games on our next episode. We'll preview those. Plenty of time to do that. But I did have a lot of fun today talking about these coaches, the decisions that have been made for the Carolina Panthers and the New York Giants. They have their guys going forward, as well as talking about these college quarterbacks. Fun episode today, bud.
No, a lot of fun, man. I'm looking forward to really digging down. We talk about keeping the main thing. Now that the calendar is flipping, we're beginning to fast forward quickly to the draft. Should be a lot of fun to talk about these prospects. I think this is a very, very good class, one that has a lot of sex appeal for the fans.
There you go. Fun episode today. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Thanks to Nabil for producing this bad boy. We'll be back with another episode where, again, we'll preview the playoff games this upcoming weekend. Thanks for listening to Move the Sticks. We'll see you next time.